cloud, and they start talking very long distances off the F1 or F2 reflection of the ionosphere. Okay, if the sunspot cycle is very low and the ionosphere ain't there, but I want to communicate on those frequencies. And I've got one group of military guys in country A, and I got an ionosphere that ain't cooperative. I can set up one of these arrays, like Hawk, where I create artificial ionization. I send them a whole lot of power. The ionosphere absorbs it. I artificially ionize the ionosphere. And so during the time, that's what I think you're discussing. Back to you, Walt. KQRI, WM DetectNet.
There was some question about that Harp array possibly causing, I know you say heating of the ionosphere, opening up possible very good communications channels, but also possibly altering weather patterns way up there in the stratosphere. So not too much said about it publicly. I just read a lot about it on the internet in addition to what I've heard and seen on TV, again, with the science channels. So, very, very interesting. I'm just listening on the side. Very, very nice information you're putting forth. Thank you so much. KB2FQN here.
Okay, Frank. The majority, 99% of the weather you and I experience, Walt, is in the troposphere. 0 to 6 miles up is where 99% of our weather comes from. Now, when it comes to what the sun can do to you, if you've got a coronal mass expulsion, a CME, where the sun sends out a zillion pounds of material in one great big blast, and it comes and hits our magnetosphere, and a lot of particles get deposited into the Van Allen belt, and the particles that hit at the North Pole and the South Pole cause aurora australis, aurora borealis, and that has a minor effect on our weather. So when you heat up the ionosphere, you're changing that secondary chunk of weather a little bit. Are you really changing what's going on in the first 6 miles of our troposphere? I doubt it. Could you turn on and turn off a hurricane with that, or a tornado? I think not very likely. When you look at the powers required, I mean, a good hurricane like Hurricane Katrina is dissipating the amount of energy of multiple atomic bombs going off every single second. During all of those seconds, minutes, hours, and days of that particular hurricane. The total amount of energy involved in a hurricane is just way beyond astronomical by normal human standards. And so the little minuscule things that mankind does to try to steer the hurricane, to heat up the ionosphere, to modify the weather, to modify the troposphere, we're not even spitting in the ocean. I mean, you and I can spit in the ocean, and in theory I can calculate how much I've raised the tide because I spit into the ocean. Or by some other means, I put fluid into the ocean. I won't go into that, but you know what I mean. You and I can calculate whether or not the ocean is now one molecule higher. Am I really making a change in the height of the tide? Not enough to talk about. By the same token, the Harp system heating up the ionosphere, is it really changing the weather? My spitting in the ocean might be going to be creating all kinds of damage downrange. Now, when it comes to the really massive things that mankind is doing, let me drop, where we're burning fossil fuels, whether it be hydrocarbons in the form of wood and coal and oil and petroleum, and running automobiles and factories and power stations and whatever. We're putting zillions of pounds of carbon dioxide and other things into the atmosphere every day, creating global warming. Is that going to have a long-term effect? Now you're talking about something. We're talking about 10 to the 14 joules of energy being dissipated in some reasonable length of time by way of all the fossil fuels we're using in our vehicles and power stations and so on, hydrocarbon fuels, and what we're doing to the atmosphere. There you're doing something. And there you're talking about something that's a billion times bigger than anything Harp can do. There you stand the chance. You're at the threshold now of, in a long-term effect, creating a difference in weather patterns, creating a difference in climate, changing whether or not you get droughts and monsoons in certain areas of the country? Are you going to be displacing people because where they used to get a monsoon, they now have a desert? Where they used to have a desert, they now have a flood, and so on. And so you're displacing populations, you're disturbing political boundaries, and you're doing all kinds of things because of global warming. You're melting the amount of ice that's locked up in the North Pole and the South Pole. You're raising the sea level, and some of the land that's now inhabited is going to slowly go underwater. And now you're really doing something. And so in the big picture, should we really worry about global warming? Should we stop it? Or should we have adaptive people to just move off the land that becomes a desert and move away from the seashore that got flooded and learn to live in other places and learn to live with the global warming? There's a lot of pros and cons there. No simple answer. But there you stand a chance of really doing something globally. But is HOP doing something to the local weather? You can see I'm pretty skeptical. You can calculate how much, but I think we're talking about one flea's worth of change here, so to speak. That's an opinion. You know a little bit about what that opinion's based on. Anybody got any further questions or comments on all of this crazy jazz, give me a call. That is a name. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KY.
Well recognized. Anyone else?
You got it. QN with this hot thing. I still do believe deep down in my soul that it's affecting the jet stream. And I don't know if you've been observing jet stream patterns, but you never know. You never know. Again, it's my opinion also. I'm not the expert, but you know what? The experts are playing with these things. And even Tesla said he can do massive things with just a little bit of light frequencies and whatnot. He could crack the Earth open. So I'll leave it to your imaginations. KB2LQN here. Sorry about that, Mel.
No, you got a good point there, Mel. I mean, Frank. Here we go, Walt. Tesla did believe he could do some pretty big things. By percolation theory, occasionally you can. I'll give you two examples of percolation theory. When you get a huge amount of land with super dry conditions like you had in California, huge dry tinderbox of land, and he drops one lit match on one piece of straw at the right edge of a state park, many square miles of fire, burning down houses, killing firemen, and doing terrible things, and the man who set that match, a seemingly innocent act, if he did it with enough knowledge, is really committing murder. It's a criminal act, and that poor guy, if they can prove he did it, is going to be incarcerated for a lot of his life, if not go to the electric chair. By the same token, it is possible that if you wait for just the right weather condition, that a butterfly flapping his wings in Peking, China, can 2 weeks later create a thunderstorm in California because he's made an extremely minor perturbation to a system that was extremely well set up. Is HOP going to do that? HOP is heating up the material in the atmosphere that is absorptive. Ordinary air in the troposphere for the first 6 miles will not absorb 430 megacycle energy. It's only when you get up to an ionospheric altitude, which is way above our weather envelope, that you've got the right material that can become an ionosphere of ionized material. So he's doing heating with the HOP system at a very high altitude. It's not in the troposphere, it's in the ionosphere, much, much higher up. Does the ionosphere control our weather? The jet stream is part of the troposphere, way down low in the first 6 miles, whereas the ionosphere, I forget the exact number of miles, I think it's something like 60 miles up, not 6 miles. So can you move the jet stream, which is part of the troposphere, by changing some heating on something that's 10 times higher? I won't say it's impossible, but it's a lot more difficult. Are the right conditions there set up where you can get the so-called butterfly effect of Peking, China versus California? Interesting question. For some further study. No, I know you had some comments on all this. Go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Getting back to the Ohio State U radio observatory, you mentioned the map. The mapping was done between minus 36 to a plus 63 degrees of the sky. And you asked about synchronization. The system was synchronized with what they call a five-reel clock, and it was accurate to 0.05 seconds. I just dug up the map, you know, that they of the map of the, what they, you know, in other words, observed with their system. It's quite detailed. They were able to, I think, map some around 20,000 different radio sources, Dick, over.
Yeah, the way you pronounce it is a little bit different, though. It's called a sidereal clock. And what is a sidereal clock versus a diurnal clock, a so-called civil time clock? You can have a lot of fun with your technically oriented friends by asking a very simple question that almost gets into astronomy. To the nearest one revolution, how many times does the Earth rotate in 1 year? You ask that to all of your friends, 95% of them are going to say 365 revolutions per year. The Earth turns 365 times. I see the sun rise 365 and one quarter times per year. That's how many times the Earth rotates. It's 366, not 365. Because in the process that the Earth's rotating, you see the sun rise and set 365 times, but you've gone around the sun once in the process of doing that. You've made one more revolution as far as the stars are concerned. An astronomer only occasionally looks at the sun. 99.9% of the time, he's looking at something else. Everything else in the sky comes up and down 366 and a quarter times per year, not 365. A clock that keeps that straight is a sidereal clock. A day in a civil clock, a diurnal clock, is 24 hours exactly. A sidereal clock, one day is not 24 hours, 23 hours, 56 minutes, 4 and a fraction seconds. The reason for that is that each day on a sidereal clock has to be a little bit shorter by roughly 1 degree of rotation. Because the sidereal clock doesn't care about the fact that you're going around the sun. A man with a sidereal clock is finding out, my favorite star, when is it going to rise above the horizon, and when is it going to set below the horizon? It'll rise and set the exact same time every single day on a sidereal clock. On my civil clock, that star rises and sets 4 minutes earlier every single day because I've gained, if I got that right, is it 4 minutes? Let me see. 1 degree, I think it's 4 minutes. Yeah, 4 minutes in time. So that star will rise 4 minutes earlier and set 4 minutes earlier every day on my civil clock. On my sidereal clock, it rises and sets exact same time. So, as I said, you can have a lot of fun with your technical friends. How many times does the Earth rotate in 1 year? And the word rotation... And the word rotation only has meaning with reference to the so-called fixed stars in space. The sun is just some Johnny-come-lately, so to speak, local star, very important to our existence, but it's a star in the middle of the smallest and the largest possible. It's just an average-sized star in an average location, somewhat in the midway between the downtown and the suburbs of this particular galaxy. It's just sort of an ordinary star that happens to be very important to us. But in the big scheme of things, it's not very important. So that gives you some idea of what a sidereal clock is and why you want to keep it accurate if you're a radio astronomer or an optical astronomer. If you're any kind of an astronomer, that you're looking at anything but the sun, you look at your sidereal clock. And you measure things in hours, minutes, and seconds of sidereal time. And if you want to break that down into degrees, or you call it right ascension. And right ascension is the time on a sidereal clock in celestial coordinate system. And your up and down is called declination. When it comes to looking at a globe, you call it latitude, lines of latitude. Well, when you're looking at a celestial globe, the lines of latitude are called declination. Positive and negative declination is above and below the equator. Right and left ascension is with reference to early and late on the sidereal clock, angles in space, fixed positions in space, believe it or not, which move to you. I mean, if I drew a line at 0 hours, 0 minutes, and 0 seconds on a sidereal clock, that is a particular direction in space. And there's a particular star in that direction. It used to be called the first point of Aries. The constellation Aries has a star, and that's on Earth, our point of reference is Greenwich Mean Time, what's happening in Greenwich, England, so to speak. But when it comes to a sidereal clock, what's happening to that particular point in space? And if I watch that particular point in space with my telescope, because I'm on a rotating Earth, that point in space is moving continuously because I'm on a rotating planet looking at a fixed thing, and it's moving 1 degree in position every 4 minutes of time, or 15 degrees per hour that star is moving. The star really ain't moving, I'm moving. But as far as I'm concerned, it looks like the star is moving. That's the, and they call it right ascension because when you're aimed, when you face your face due south, and you look up at your star, and you aim your arm and your hand at that particular star, and you watch it move, the half star appears to be moving to the right. That's part of why they call it right ascension. What if any of that's ever been explained to you by Bob Dixon about K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Roger, K2KEY. You know, I was really not my expertise in that subject. I was looking just really to pass my test and get out and earn a living. But it was very interesting, you know, to stand there and look at a lot of things. And funny, he wrote it out to me, sidereal clock. I guess it's sidereal clock, yeah. He got it written out phonetically for me here. I'm actually pronouncing exactly the way he has it phonetically. But this was, you know, fascinating to see that, you know, I had never seen before liquid, night those days, you know, quite a piece of equipment. So it was the fascination of visiting, you know, and of course, Bob Dixon, he would get a hold of you, good night, that was it. He could talk about things financially, practical for what was going on there. I think they were looking to get rid of this because... they wanted the money, basically, and that's why I think it just, it just was a situation where they could do more with the land pick over.
You could say that they had gleaned 80% of everything they could possibly glean out of that telescope. The telescope was made out of a great big parabolic reflector that was something like 100 feet plane out in front of this parabolic reflector. And then on the other side of the aluminum was this movable reflector, a flat reflector, where you could tip.
Potting SWR. One guy says, oh, now I know what this thing is all about. He says, I've twisted it and turned it so many different ways and never can make head or tail of it. And he says, step by step, he says, it's the only way to really learn an application of it. All right, so I said I emailed these people back that I would do another simple application, and you just alluded to what basically what it's going to do is a demonstration of matching and a little bit more of an insight into what goes into matching to a line. So unless you have any other comments, maybe I'll just give another little slight, we'll take a very slow information of how to use the Smith chart over.
Yep, I'd do that, and if we have a lot of empty time next week, I'll give the next level of transformer understanding. Again, engineers walk out of school not knowing how an antenna works. They also work out of there not knowing how a transformer works. They know a couple of formulas, but really how you make a transformer, that information is hidden from them. So maybe we'll cover a little bit more of that next week. Go ahead with Smith Chart this week, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. All right, so those who were listening and have prepared them with the email telling them to have the Smith Chart ready, I need a compass tonight and a straight edge. Let me give you a practical problem. I had a mobile rig when I was in fact on the Ohio. I used to get on 3823.820, 75 meters every night with the net around 8 o'clock at night and try to, you know, talk to the fellows here in Brooklyn and just keep in touch sort of. And what I had in the mobile, I won't get into now how I did this, but it was quite a project. I added a 750-watt amplifier. And I used my transceiver was a National NCX5, which would be kind of large compared to what today you have. So this was basically the layout in the mobile, the antenna in the mobile. I tried to find a coil with the highest Q, so it was quite a large coil for 75 meters. And I didn't ride around with it. I only put that coil, that antenna system, on the mobile when I was fixed mobile, basically, and on 75 meters. Otherwise, I was operating 20 meters. All right, let me let it drop for a second. Okay, now take your Smith chart. I think it's getting late, so we'll get right to it. Take your Smith chart. Now, as last week I showed you, we held a Smith chart with the axis, what we call the axis of reels. We had it horizontal. We had the short end to the left, and we had the infinity end to the right. Tonight we're going to do a little different. We're going to take the Smith chart, and we're going to stick it so that where it says 180 plus or minus 180 degrees or 0, 0 will be at the top. The bottom will be what I'm going to give you a practical application. Let me let it drop. The application is that in my mobile with that setup, with 750 watts, I had an SWR that was about 4.5, almost 5, a little high for that, I was afraid for that amplifier. So I decided, well, what can you do? You could put a tuner in the car, of course, and but again, that would be another big box. And then I said to myself, why can't I have a little fixed tuner of some sort with a couple of components in it, rather than the whole box, because I'm only operating in around that frequency, plus or minus on that frequency. Because, the antenna being such a compromise with that huge coil, even with the high Q, didn't have much of a bandwidth on 75 meters. So what I did, let me let it drop. What I did, basically, I took my noise bridge, which was a homebrew noise bridge, not the best of them. I mean, it had, but I wanted to get an idea of what's going on, basically. So I took a measurement. And I got a resistive measurement of 12 ohms and a reactance of minus J17. So this was basically what I was reading on a noise bridge. So I said, let's take the Smith chart and plot it. So the first thing I did is took this 12 minus J17 and I normalized it like we did last week by dividing it by 50. And we get 0.24 minus J 0.34, and you're going to find that and you'll find 0.24. You see 0.2 and you can count the spaces up there, so you know it's got to be approximate. You don't have to be perfect, you know, and then you follow around that circle, that resistance circle, until you find 0.34. now we're going to go left because remember this is minus, so that means it's capacitive. So we're going to the left now of the center axis. Anybody have any questions so far? Okay, now you're locating that point at 0.24 minus 34, 0.34, and you're going to put a pencil mark there and mark it A. Now with your compass, we're going to take the tip of the compass, put it on 1.0, like we did last week in the middle, open up the compass and put the pencil on point A, and we're going to swing a circle completely around. Anybody have any questions about that? Okay. Now, where we now you'll notice that there is a circle that goes through 1.0 in the middle of Smith chart. That is actually our circle where we'll really be working with also, because that's going to actually be our true 50 ohm line that we have. In other words, we're working with that 50 ohm line. And what we want to do now is really see what basically is going on. So what we're going to do now, from the center point where it was 1.0, we're going to take our straight edge and go right through point A. In other words, we're going to extend from 1.0 right through point A, right out to the edge of the Smith chart. I hope I didn't confuse anybody with that, over. If not, okay. And I want you to mark that, where it goes through the top of the Smith chart there, I want you to mark that begin, the word begin, with an arrow going to the right. And I'll tell you what that's for in a couple of minutes. Next thing I want you to do is take the straight edge. Now, if you look at 1.0, and then you look at this circle that goes through it, and you see the circle that we drew through point A, you'll see there's an intersection point there. Again, you're going to take the straight edge, go one through from 1.0, right through the intersection of that, right out to the edge of the Smith chart, and you're going to mark that point C. You're going to mark that line C. That's for the capacitive intercept point. Anybody have any questions? Okay, next thing we're going to do now. Now, if you'll notice, what we have when we went through point A, this is our original condition that we have. What we want to do is to correct this to get onto as close to the 50 ohm line as possible. So here's something we're going to do different. We're going to rotate. We're going to actually rotate what we have on the Smith chart now. In other words, what I said up on top, begin and the arrow, you'll notice that there is on the top of the Smith chart ring, it says wavelength towards generator. The generator refers to your transmitter. So that's the wavelength and direction of the transmitter that we're concerned of. Anybody have any questions? Okay. Now, the distance that we're going to rotate, I'll tell you right now, because you can work this out later, you can make a note, is approximately 36 degrees. You'll notice it's laid out on a Smith chart. You have plus or minus 180 degrees. You'll notice it goes around the Smith chart. And the Smith chart actually is up 180 degrees each side, really. It looks like the circle. Not, it doesn't show in 360. It shows actually 180 degrees on each side. So we're going to go from begin. We're going to rotate 36 degrees right to the zero line. Anybody have any question on that? Over. Okay, now in doing that, we're also rotating, theoretically, if you can picture it, we'd be rotating point C, would be going the same distance. So now point C, 36 degrees rotated, will wind up at a point that you'll see, and if you plot it there on the Smith chart, let's see, what did I plot? I got myself a right, what I plotted. I worked it out there earlier. I plotted it to, now it'll be 0.374 exactly. I worked it out mathematically to get exactly, but it's 374 that I can recall what I did here. 0.374, you'll see where it'll come up on the Smith chart, that plotting point. Anybody else? Now, if we read that point now, and now what we're going to do is we basically, if we convert that back, we'll find out what exactly is our true values here. And when we convert it back to our original reading, we'll find that we have 84.5 ohms capacitive. That's what that'll show. 84.5 ohms capacitive. So if we can visualize the circuit now, we're going to have the line We're going to put a capacitor in series with it that has 84.5 ohms resistive capacitive at that frequency. And now, because that would be 50 now minus 50 minus J 84.5, we'd have to also now put a counter and inductor in to get us back so that we put 50 ohms to balance that out. So if we put now an 84.5 inductor, so now that we have plus 84.5 and a minus 84.5 on that thing, we'll plus J0. I hope that didn't confuse anybody. Maybe you can critique it over.
Mel, your microphone switch is occasionally dropping out for a fraction of a second.
Okay, then what was missed? Maybe you can fill in the blanks.
We didn't miss anything, but you were just at the threshold of something like that.
Okay. Sorry, yeah, I got this microphone. You got to really hang on the button tight. Okay, anyhow, but what we did, if everybody understands, we basically rotated it. We read the new point that now the capacitive reactance is. And basically now we're taking 84.5 ohm capacitive reactance, and to balance that off, we're going to take an 84.5 ohm inductive reactance. We're going to put them in series so that we're going to have a summation of 50 plus J0. Now, converting that over, what I did to convert that over, I just worked out by the formulas, and I found that if I put a 2 microhenry coil in there, I bought B&W coils, they used to sell them, you break off the number of turns you want, and the capacitor came out to 493 PF at that frequency. So what I did is I took a 500 picofarad standard capacitor, if you find the final sections of transmitters that have 2 screws on it, and I made enough twinkle, you know, touched up the, of course, the tap, because this is approximate, and made myself a little tuner that way. Anybody have any questions? Okay, well, basically, in other words, I made a fixed tuner for that frequency, because basically that's where the only place I was going to operate. But that gives you an insight that this is the way, a simple way of matching to a line without, you know, sitting there and playing around. You can fiddle around with tuners and try measuring components and all, but this will give you a way to give you an insight that how simple you can match if you just, you know, use a little bit ingenuity to with the Smith chart. Okay, let me shoot it back to Dick. Maybe he can critique if I left out any blanks here. Over.
WS2N. WS2N recognized. Now, I think you've indicated what you did. And so you made up an LC network, length of line, if you were rotating, and the 490 picofarad and a few millihenry allowed you to impedance match that antenna at that fixed frequency of 3820 kilohertz, and therefore you had a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on that mobile antenna, and you could talk from your buddies from Ohio back to Brooklyn. And I bet it worked pretty well. Is that true, Mel? And then pass it over to Paul.
Okay, yeah, Roger. That was a very simple network in that I made up, and nothing really, you know, magic about it, except that it sufficed that you don't have to have, you know, a tuner with you. But of course, with a tuner, another big box, and it would have to be adjusted. You know, you bounce around, and surely would be readjusting. But all we did basically was we plotted the SWR, we rotated it to a normal position where we're going to go, so we read the new point with everything turned, and just read it off there and made, like you say, a combination L inductive series with a capacitance, because 84.5 ohms capacitive has to be balanced off by an inductor, same inductor. The two of them in series will give you a summation of reactance of plus J0, so you got 50 plus J0, and it dropped the SWR to a reasonable, under 2 to 1. It wasn't perfect, but close enough that you know, you don't have to think about it over.
Very fine. Paul? Good words happened on Tuesday from Mr. Michael, like, I think his name Griffith, I guess it is, the administrator of NASA, and we're going to get not only a update and repair of Hubble, we're going to get a 10-to-1 increase in sensitivity. It's going to work on some new wavelengths that that's not operative right now. And so the Hubble huggers have got to be good and happy. WS2N, K2RW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. I was actually trying to get back to Mel with his Smith chart, but the Hubble has been saved. Like you said, Halloween the year. Announcement came out. Now, this will be the fifth mission to service the Hubble. So, outlived its lifetime. I think originally they said 15 years for the Hubble. And it's doing very well now. So that'll bring it to 2013 and beyond. Yeah, if they go up 2008. And one of the members of the team is that's going to be going up there is Rumfall Park on here, right from Long Island. He's gone up before. I forget his name.